So by way of an introduction then, I wanted to express at the beginning in a similar way as I did last time how I've been feeling about what we're going through right now. Not just Trish and myself, but also perhaps what many other listeners out there might be going through with regards to a change of thinking regarding the timing of the holy days and the calendar. When I say going through, what we're going through, we're not going through anything like heavy persecution or anything like that, but change is often painful, and we know that the only constant is change. Mental or and or emotional pain that I've been feeling lately is not just because I'm resistant to change, which I am, which I believe we all are. Most or all human beings are resistant to change. But the pain I'm feeling, it reminded me somewhat similar to that experience that I experienced during other periods of major change in my past spiritual life. One of the first one is when I was first called by God, first called into God's way of life. And at that time, it was necessary to gently part company with many of my former friends and activities, even to a certain extent with my own parents and siblings who didn't agree with our spiritual direction and still don't. You know, not that they give us a hard time on it. And secondly, let's go back to 1994, 1995, when we realized that the Worldwide Church of God, our former fellowship there, was being hijacked by after Mr. Armstrong's death, by the church leadership of that time. And that we found that we needed to part company with that organization. And many of our longtime friends who stayed with that organization, that separation caused pain. And other times since then, when we found it necessary to part company with Church of God groups that we'd been fellowshipping with there regularly, and again with the brethren there that we used to spend quite a bit of time with, and from then on, so there was that separation, there was that parting of company. And I'm sure that many or most of you have experienced similar feelings and the associated pain that comes with with those feelings. And again, the common factor between those three periods that I just described, those periods of major change in our spiritual life, and the present situation, is the sadness of the potential of parting company with the loved ones who we've spent much quality time with over the years. Let's go back a couple of months, or say a year or so, when we recently changed our stance or our belief with regards to Sabbath food, which we talked about at length. There was some impact at that time, and the impact was relatively minor. Of course, we needed to change our ways of doing food related things on Sabbaths and holy days, and yes, we needed to turn down some invitations on the Sabbath for restaurants and stuff like that, but surprisingly few. We quickly got the hang of it, and others who were not in agreement on that particular point, they got the hang of it too, for the most part. What we did is we agreed to disagree without being disagreeable. And so far, this is the Sabbath food thing now, it hasn't really caused any major or permanent rifts between us and any of our brethren. And that's just as it should be, I believe. Now I'm aware that other brethren have experienced much worse responses, and so that, you know, we've probably perhaps had it easy, I don't know. But we have to be careful. This is going to roll into the calendar subject as well, that a person can bring persecution or criticism on himself or herself if we handle things in an aggressive manner or in an otherwise unwise manner. Please turn to Proverbs chapter 15, and this is probably one of the most well-known Proverbs, Proverbs 15, and verse 1, just read that one verse for now. A soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. That happens between brethren too. Now, I'm sure that we all try to go by the soft answer proverb, and Trish and I did with regards to the Sabbath food issue, and also by the converse of Colossians 2:16, excuse me, which, you know, I know that I've hammered that over and over again, but by refraining from unrighteously judging others who might disagree with us in respect of meat and drink and Sabbath and holy days, we try to avoid harsh responses and arguments, of course, and so far, for the most part, it's worked. But now, as we embark on this change, and this change, brethren, is not a change to something new, by the way, but this is rather a change to something old, whereby we believe that we are reverting to and restoring a piece of doctrine that is part of the faith once delivered to the saints of yesteryear. But as we embark on this change, I'm disturbed by the feeling that once again, what I say and what I do will possibly cause additional separation between brethren. Separation from brethren, of course, who will stay, who decide to stay with the mainstream Church of God and their continuing support for the Jews CRC calendar. What is that? CRC is the calculated rabbinic calendar that most of the Church of God groups stay with. But not only separation from those people, but also between some of those who disagree with the CRC calendar, who disagree with it. Yes, between brethren who agree with each other about the error of the postponements and the other Jewish calendar calculations that we talked about a couple of weeks ago in part 3, but who may not agree with one another on the methods and the timing of keeping the new moons or the beginning of the new year. And I've said this before, but this concerns me very much, because these disagreements and the potential for resulting separations between brethren again might contribute to the ongoing scattering of God's church and God's people. And I don't really want to do that. I don't want to be part of that. God warns against doing that. You know, that I don't want to go into those scriptures now, but God warns against us and his ministers being the cause of separation between, you know, being the cause of scattering. And I don't want to heed that. But ask the questions now. Are such major separations between God's people, are they really inevitable Are they really necessary? Are they inevitable? I'd say no. They shouldn't be. The difference of opinion regarding Sabbath food might cause some separation between some brethren for a couple of hours on a Sabbath or on a holy day. But the differences regarding of the new moons and the new year, God's new year, can cause separation between brethren for parts of the holy days and for even all of the holy days if we disagree to that extent. But if we can limit our separation to just that, and if we can refrain from falling out with one another over our differences, then I believe that's a good thing. If we don't, again, we all agree, or I think the majority of people who are listening to me now agree that the CRC calendar, the postponements, is wrong. But if we can limit our separation to keeping it at a different time until God reveals to us and gives us 100% knowledge of the way it should be, then I think it's a good thing if we can limit it to that and not fall out over it, and that we can love each other and continue on doing the best, what we believe is the right thing to do to the best of our belief and understanding. So at this point in time, right now, Trish and I, we don't yet 100% support any of the various opinions on the timings, and there's still questions. We still have there's still problems with the various, or we perceive that there are problems with virtually all of the different options and opinions. And the stage that we're at right now in our thinking and in our studies is that we definitely agree that the Jews' CRC calculations are wrong, and that the postponements are wrong, and that they should not be supported by God's true church in the New Testament. But again, we have not yet come to the point where we're 100% totally convinced which combination of the various new moon and new year timing opinions is correct. So am I saying then, as some of the, and this is, I know that there are quite a few of the Church of God leaders and ministers who use this to stay with the status quo. So am I saying that because I'm not totally sure which of the many opinions is the correct one, and because I don't want to be the cause of further scattering of God's church, that for the sake of church unity, that we should ignore all we've learned so far and go back to observing the CRC? Is that what I'm saying? No, it's not. Absolutely not. And for this upcoming spring Holy Day season now, 2014, we have to make our best decision. Trish and I have to make our best decision for our household on the basis of the information that we've learned so far. And we have to choose the option that we believe is the closest to what God's Word says. And I encourage you to do the same. Many of you have already made a choice, and that's fine, that's good. But if you haven't, you have to make the decision. I'm not going to make the decision for you. I can't. I don't have that authority. But again, for Trish, for our household, for Trish and myself, if new scriptural, historical, and/or astronomical evidence comes to light in the process of time, then our decision might change. And if it does, we're not going to keep it to ourselves, but we'll let you know, clearly announce it. I don't foresee that, but that's the way, We're supposed to be growing in grace and knowledge, and as God reveals that knowledge to us, then change might take place. But again, I want to assure you, everybody who's listening to us right now, I am not going to try to browbeat you into agreeing with my choice. And if you do disagree with my choice, if you do, and if you choose another combination that you believe to be closest to what God's Word says, I am not going to give you a hard time about it. And I promise not to unrighteously judge you in respect of Holy Day or New Moon. And I ask that you would grant me and Trish the same allowance. So once again, as necessary, let's agree to disagree without being disagreeable. So that's my long-winded introduction. So let's get into the main body of the sermon. In the time that I have today, I want to attempt to explain in as simple terms as possible the various methods that I'm aware of for the determination of the timing of the new moons, God's new moons and God's new years. And if I miss anything, I want you to let me know, and we'll slot them in a future sermon. Now, various groups and various leaders and various ministers use various combinations of what I refer to as peace parts. For instance, one group might combine the way they begin their new year. They might begin their new year according to the appearance of the barley in Israel, and they might time their months by one of the calculated methods. Okay, that's one combination of two of the peace parts. Another group might begin their new year according to the spring equinox. Okay. And they might begin their months by observation of the first crescent. So that's as you can see, that's a different combination there of the different piece parts. And as there might be, if you go into this mathematically, there might be many combination of the piece parts. So what I'll do is I'll go through the various individual piece parts themselves, and hopefully that'll make it clear as we go through. I will not go into the CRC methods used by the mainstream Jewish and Church of God groups, because we went through them in quite a bit of detail back in part 3. So I don't need to go through that again. And for today's examples, I'll refer to the next new moon, which is actually the lunar conjunction is tomorrow night, Sunday night, and that's called the dark moon. So we're going to refer to that. Now, one question that is common to all of the options is whether the new moon should be calculated or viewed from a central point, which is usually Jerusalem, or from your own home location. And it's not the same as the Sabbath sunset, and I believe that for most decisions that a central point is absolutely necessary, because it fixes the new moon day and thus fixes the days, the holy days around the world. Whereas if you choose the home location option, I'm not criticizing it if you believe that that's right, but I believe that if you choose that home location option, that there's going to be some brethren at certain points around the world who could be keeping the feasts on different days. Okay, if you go by the sighting of the new moon or even the calculation of the new moon at various points around the world. Okay, I believe that I sent out a copy of a diagram with last week when I sent out my email, and I printed out copies for the brethren who are here. And if you don't have a copy, and you'd like to have one to refer to as we go through this, you can, if you're listening on a computer, you can go to www.tcog.ca. TCOG, the Church of God. www.tcog, and you'll find it on the home page there. Okay. So let's get into this. Let's look first. We'll look at a couple of new moon methods of calculation, and then we'll look at a couple of new year calculations. Okay, let's start with, let's call it option one, and this is the Roman calendar conjunction day. And this is normally calculated, but it really couldn't be a sighted one. This has got to be a calculated one. And the supporters of this, so let me repeat that. Option one, Roman calendar conjunction day. And the supporters of this method keep the new moon day on the Roman calendar day that the moon goes completely dark, no matter what the specific time of the conjunction is, whether it's before or after sunset. So if you look at your diagram there, you'll see that this month they would be keeping it on Sunday, March the 30th, tomorrow, because the conjunction occurs tomorrow at 9:46 p.m. in Jerusalem. Okay, so those brethren who keep that, they will keep all of tomorrow, and probably from sunset tonight, I don't know, they would keep that as the new moon day. Okay. Now, as we go through these, I'm going to point out potential problems. Now, the people who keep these options, they may have answers for these potential problems, but the one with this one is that this method appears to disregard the fact that God's day is run from sunset to sunset. Okay, and although something that's worth thinking about, that although the moon usually appears dark when viewed from the earth, at least one day before the conjunction and one day after, there are photographs available that have been taken with using high-tech equipment, high-resolution equipment, showing that the tiny sliver of the new crescent appears within mere seconds after the exact instant of conjunction. There's some astonishing photographs that you can get on the internet that show that. And the guy shows all of his equipment that he used to take those pictures. But again, perhaps the main objection to this method is that their new moon day, if you think about it, could include many hours of the old moon on this day before the conjunction time. So if you've got 9:46 Jerusalem time, and then you've actually got, what you've got is, you'd have three hours of the new moon, and you'd have 21 hours of the old moon, right? Okay, so that's the kind of thing that can happen. So you would end up having, in reality, observing more hours of the old moon if you choose that option than you would of the new moon. Okay, so if this gets confusing to you, or if I'm not explaining it very well, please don't hesitate to get in touch with me and tell me that I'm talking rubbish, or I don't understand it, or I'm not doing too well. So that's option one. Now let's go to option two. Option two. This is the first visual sighting. The first visual sighting. Now, some of the supporters of this method, again, they might tell you that this was the original method that was given to Moses, and it was used by the ancient Israelites. But I've yet to see verifiable proof of this. Maybe they have some, and if they have, I'd be glad to see it. But there's quite a few potential problems with this method as well, and they're quite obvious. The first one is if you rely on visual sighting, what if the weather is cloudy at the viewing point? Okay, whether that be Jerusalem or whatever. What if it's cloudy? That's the most obvious one. The second one is, what if I assume that they have these official viewers. Okay, no, I don't know who they are. I think that different organizations rely on different official viewers for the sightings. But what if the eyesights of those people are impaired? I don't know, I'm just saying, you know, that's a possibility. Even worse than that, and this is one that I've heard has happened, what if the official viewers, for some reason, are dishonest about their sightings? You know, what if they've got something for a certain reason that they would say that it was seen or wasn't seen at a certain time? So again, with this one, the uncertainties and inefficiencies of this method can pose some real difficulties and potentially as well a wastage of funds for the planning of church services, for the planning of travel arrangements to the holy days, to the feasts, and for time off work. Okay, using tables, new moon tables, the sighters can partially predict the date and the time that the first crescent should be visible to the naked eye on a clear evening. And I've got a calculated new moons chart here, and it shows the 30th of March, that's tomorrow. It says not visible. It's got the 31st of March, probably visible, and the 1st of April, visible. So we'll come back to that in a minute. So that's the kind of thing. So you can find, they can partially predict when it's going to be visible. When the date and the time of the first crescent should become visible to the naked eye on a clear evening. Now the time difference between the lunar conjunction, which is 9:46 tomorrow night, was it 9:46? Tomorrow evening, the time difference between that and the ability for the first viewing of the first crescent can vary month to month. And that's because the moon is in an elliptical orbit, like an egg-shaped orbit around the Earth, not a completely circular orbit around the Earth. And so the time difference from month to month can vary from approximately 15 hours up to 23 hours, and again on a clear evening. So 1 month you might be able to see it after. I'd seen records of like 12 or 13 hours. I can't remember what the actual was, but I think that the average is approximately 15 hours to 23 hours the max. Now, so if the weather at the viewing point is cloudy on the evening that they expect to see it, then, and so they don't see the new moon, then some of the, I call them sighters, and that's not in a derogatory way, it's just some sighters then defer to the following sunset. Okay, assuming that it must be there even though we can't see it, or it would be visible if only those pesky clouds weren't in the way. So the next prediction then is that the first crescent might be visible, and this is talking about this month now, the end of the month here. So what they would say is that the first crescent might be visible, according to this table here, by sunset on March 30th. Definitely not visible tomorrow night on the 30th. They say that it might be visible by sunset on March 31st. But because they feel that might is not good enough, then they plan to begin their new moon day and the time at the time of the next sunset, in other words, beginning on the evening of April the 1st. Okay? And if it's cloudy on that evening, then they'll go for the next sunset on April the 2nd. Okay? Okay, let's go to option 3. Option 3. And this is the sunset after conjunction, and this is normally calculated. So the supporters of this method start their new moon day at the first sunset after the conjunction time. The first sunset after the conjunction time. So again now, the lunar conjunction will occur at 9:46 Jerusalem time. And these times are not, you know, they're pretty accurate. And again, that man who took those photographs, I looked at the photographs and compared them with the tables, and they were bang on within a second of what the table showed them to be. So the conjunction will occur at 9:46 Jerusalem time tomorrow evening, Sunday, March the 30th. Okay, but that is almost 3 hours after tomorrow evening sunset. Okay, tomorrow evening sunset is 6:57 p.m. Jerusalem time. So the adherents of this method then will start their new moon day and new year day at the first sunset after the conjunction. Okay. And again, it's around the same time, at 6:57 p.m. Jerusalem time on Monday, March the 31st. Okay, did you get that? You'll see that on your diagram there. The adherents of this method will start their new moon day, and of course new year day as well, because this is the first one of the new year, at the first sunset after the conjunction at 6:57 p.m. Jerusalem time on Monday evening, March the 31st. Now this method frequently, not always, but very frequently would coincide with the new moon days and holy days with those of the sighting methods. A possible problem with this method is that some people claim that the ancient Israelites and ancient Christians as well did not have the technology or the know-how to be able to determine the time of the conjunction. I don't believe that. I mean, I believe we should not shortchange the ancient Israelites and the ancient Christians. You know, they weren't a bunch of dummies. Let's just have a look at the Egyptians and see what they were able to do with astronomy. It was incredible. And the Babylonians as well. Are the ancient Israelites who were blessed by God, were they any more lacking in technological skills than the Egyptians and the Babylonians? I don't think so. I believe that they definitely did have the ability to make accurate determinations of the conjunction time. Primarily, and first of all, by revelation from God, number one. God's going to give his oracles and he's going to give his methods to his people. Is he going to leave them? He's going to give them to Moses, the Israelites. But secondarily, they could confirm that through many, many repeated detailed observations of the lunar cycles. That's where these tables come from, is they come through mathematics, they come through arithmetic of really smart guys who know how to do, and girls too, sorry, not just guys, of people who know how to do this, and that's where those tables come from. And they're verified, they could work them out mathematically, and then they say, let's check this out, and they send teams out every month, every year. Oh yeah, that's exactly right. Could the Israelites do that? You better believe they could. It's an important thing to remember that not everything that happened in Bible times is recorded in the Bible. Now, that's not a blasphemous statement. Think about it. Think about all of the things that happened. And I say not every significant thing that happened in Bible times is recorded in the Bible. Think about Uzzah's, the great earthquake that took place in time of Uzziah. We don't know. We know very little about that. That's just one example. You think about all of the calendar details and how God gave them to Israel along with his other oracles, and we don't know all of the hows and the whys and the wherefores of that. I honestly believe, and it's not recorded, but I believe that God gave the correct instructions with regards to his holy days, his Sabbaths, were not, they were made for man. They weren't just made for the Israelites. So they were not just made for the Jews. They weren't just made for the Christians. They were made for man. And I believe that God likely, almost definitely, gave these instructions at first to Adam and Eve. Okay? Did Adam and Eve keep God's Sabbath? Did he expect them to keep God's Sabbath? Obviously did. What about the holy days? I believe so. Okay. Secondly, I believe that he would have given them to Moses and the Israelites. Remember, they were in Egypt for a long time. I'm not saying, all of those patriarchs in between, Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, I believe that it was all passed down to them. It could have been lost in the Egyptian captivity. But secondly, God repeated it to Moses, and this is my speculation now, was given to Moses and the Israelites when they were coming out of Egypt. And thirdly, that it may have been necessary for him to repeat them to the Jewish leadership after the Babylonian captivity. And I'm not sure exactly what they were allowed to do during the Babylonian captivity, whether they could still keep the holy days. And then we know that Jesus and his human parents and his disciples kept the new moons and the holy days at the same time as their fellow Jews. Now that's other than the Passover timing on Abib 14, but apart from that, I believe that Jesus and his human parents and his disciples kept the new moons and holy days at the same time as the other Jews. And then fifthly, that the Jews kept the proper timing after that, at least up until the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 AD, but beyond that, and possibly right up to the time of the Dark Ages and the infamous Hillel, Hillel II in the Dark Ages. Okay. Let's move on then. Let's move on to the new year. We've been through three new moon options. Let's go to the new year options. Okay, option one is very well-known one, and this is that the barley in Israel must be almost ready for the wave sheaf offering day. Okay, and we know that that is a factor. The readiness of the first fruits of some crop for the wave sheaf offering is a factor. We have to ask the question, how do we know that that crop was barley? Do we know that? How do we know that? And once we've determined that God's new year falls in the springtime, if we look at the crops of Israel, here's what we find. I'm just going to read from you. I got this from a Reader's Digest book called Jesus and His Times, really good for showing them. It shows the agricultural seasons. So going through, I won't go through all of the months, but again, starting in the first month, Abib or Nisan, that where we have the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, barley harvest in that time frame. Jumping over to the third month, Sivan, which is around May or June, time we have Pentecost or Shavuot, is the dry season begins in that area, and we have the wheat harvest. The wheat harvest in the fourth month, called Tammuz, is around June and July, and you get the first figs at that time. The fifth month is called Av, and it's in July, August. The vintage begins. That's great. The grape harvest begins. The 6 months of Elul, around August and September, you've got the real summer heat at that time, and you have the date harvest and the summer figs. Dates and figs. And the well-known Tishri, 7th month, September, October, Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, the Feast of Tabernacles, and the Last Great Day. Okay, the main harvest time is over by that time, and you've got the first rains, and it's ploughing time there. In the 8th month, Marcheshvan, October and November, there's the olive harvest at that time, the olive harvest. The 9th month is called Kislev, November and December. Again, there's no harvest time then. That's the time for grain, the planting of the grain, and the main rains come in at that time. And then jump over there to the 12th month, it's called Adar, and it's in February, March. And then you've got the almonds are in bloom at that time. The almonds are in bloom, so the almond fruit will come shortly after that. And there's a flax harvest then, a flax harvest, and then the spring rains come in. Okay, let's go to Exodus chapter 9, because some brethren have used scripture here to use this in Exodus chapter 9 and verse 31, this mention of the barley being smitten by the hail plague in Egypt, as added proof that its appearance, that the barley's appearance, must be a sign of the year's beginning. Let's look at it. Exodus chapter 9 and verse 25, just so we know where we are here. And the hail, is the hail plague from God, smote throughout all the land of Egypt, all that was in the field, both man and beast. And the hail smote every herb of the field and broke every tree of the field. Jump down to verse 31. And the flax and the barley were smitten, for the barley was in the ear. The word there is Abib. Interesting. And the flax was bold. The flax was bold. The Hebrew word is gibbol, and it means in bud. The flax was in the bud. And verse 32, but the wheat and the rye were not smitten, for they were not yet grown up. And we saw the wheat back up there, and that they were harvested in the summer. So at this time, the wheat weren't. Now, we can't really strictly go by the mention of the barley in Exodus 9:34 for two reasons. And the first, now I'm not saying it's not a factor, but we have to be careful because the location of that mention there of the barley and the flax in Egypt, because it was in Egypt, the heat down in Egypt is much greater than it is in Israel, and it gave an earlier harvest than it did in Canaan, and which is modern Israel. Some experts say that it was up to a whole month earlier, a whole month because of the heat that was down there. So Exodus 9, they're in Egypt, they're still in Egypt. Okay, so it could be a whole month difference there. Secondly, who knows what the time difference was between the seventh plague in Exodus chapter 9 there and the morrow after the Sabbath that fell within the first day of unleavened bread that year for the wave sheaf offering. We don't know what that time difference is and how long that the barley would have taken to become ripe. Okay, I've also heard that some brethren claim that the word Abib refers to barley, and some people actually think that it means barley. But if you look, and I looked through all 32 Old Testament occurrences of the word barley in the Bible there, and all of them are translated from the Hebrew word seora. That's, you don't have to turn there, but it's Strong's number 8184, and that word seora obviously has absolutely no similarity whatsoever to the word Abib. According to the lexicons, the Bible lexicons that I have, I see that the Hebrew word Abib, and that's Strong's number 24, stems from a root word meaning to be tender, and it's you'll see it rendered in the King James Version as Abib 6 times, in the ear once, we've already read that one, and green ears of corn. And that's not the kind of corn that we have in North America that they call maize. I'm not talking about that. But other than Exodus 9:31, barley is not specified and it's not implied at all in any other scripture where Abib is mentioned. Now, a couple of years, actually quite a few years ago now, back in the 80s, a church member from right here in BC, not here on the island but on the mainland, wrote to the Ministry of Agriculture in the modern state of Israel, and he asked them about the timing of the barley harvest in that region. And I got a copy of that letter, I got a copy of the reply that he got from the Ministry of Agriculture, and I'm just going to read it to you. It's not really definitive, but it'll give you some idea that the barley, you'd be really going out on a limb, if you will, to hang the new year timing on the appearance of the barley. Okay, this is from. And his name is Mr. Bar Droma, and he's the director of the Field Crops Department, or he was back then. This is going back to 1983. I'm sure it hasn't changed much since then. Here's what he says. Dear sir, I received your letter of May the 12th in which you asked for some data about barley. It is a real coincidence that recently I have been receiving two other letters from different countries, all dealing with the same subject. Well, first of all, I want to give you some general information about barley growing today in our country, which may use as a background for better understanding. As a matter of fact, barley has been diminishing steadily in our country for the last 10 to 15 years. That's interesting. And covers today no more than approximately 10% of the total small grain production. This trend is due to the much lower prices for barley in comparison with wheat prices, whereas the yields of both grains are more or less at the same level. The main region for barley growing is in the Negev, which is in the south, it says, between Beersheba and the Gaza Strip. In the Jordan Valley, there is hardly any barley left today. Among the Arab farmers in the vicinity of Jericho, there can still be found some small patches of barley. This year was a very exceptional one, again, 1983, from a climatic point of view. We've had an extreme wet and cold winter, and therefore there was a great delay in the ripening of wheat and barley. Both are sown as a rule in November, and the harvest starts around the end of April to the beginning of May. As stated, this year the first wheat and barley have been harvested not before the middle of May in the Jordan Valley. However, it is not right, of course, to make a comparison between today and the ancient time, not as far as concern the variety of barley and not the way of harvesting. Today, we have to wait with the harvest until the grain is entirely dry, which means a moisture content of 12 to 13% only. Otherwise, the mechanical harvester does not perform a clean threshing and the grain cannot be stored without further drying. In the ancient times, and even today with primitive methods, the barley and wheat were harvested with a sickle and left on the land in sheaves for further drying. Therefore, the crop could be harvested a couple of weeks earlier, even if the barley would have been harvested with 20% moisture content. As you may know, at Passover, the first omer of barley was brought as sacrifice to the temple, and before this day, the new barley was not allowed to be consumed, neither for the animals. New wheat was not allowed to be consumed before Pentecost, or at least as long as old wheat was still available. In the Talmud, it is mentioned that there were years that the barley was not yet ripe at Passover. In order to be able to bring the Omer sacrifice of barley in time to the temple, they used to sow barley upon some flat roofs in the Jericho Valley, which would be ready and apt to the sacrifice on the Passover. The Omer is not a big quantity of grain. I guess this, he says, that this rather extended answer will satisfy you, but in case there is still any information required, don't hesitate to write again. Yours sincerely, N. Bardroma, Director of Field Crops Department. Okay. There's a lot more that could be said about that, but what does it really tell us? Without going into all of the fine detail about the dates there, if you look at what the man said, it would indicate that Abib 1, the beginning of the new year, is very, very doubtful that it would fall before the spring equinox, which is normally March the 20th. As it in some calendars it does, you know, and we'll go into that in a minute. Also, it'd be very difficult and it's inefficient to set the timing of the new year and all the holy days around the world for thousands of people by waiting for the green ears of barley to appear in a certain place. Also, similar to, and I mentioned there that there's a possibility of bogus new moon sightings or lack thereof, that there is also apparently some history of instances where you've got different official barley ciders, depending on who you want to trust, okay, working on behalf of different organisations that have either artificially delayed or artificially advanced seeing the spring barley for their own ends, to further their own ends, which is a disgrace if you think about it. But that has been done. And there's ones who've chosen their own preferred barley growing locations in order to back up their own opinions and their own ciders as well. So the question there, who do you trust? Who are you going to trust to know and to tell the truth regarding whether or not the barley is at the proper stage that it would be ready to reap by wave sheaf offering day? Okay, we know, I'm not saying that we have to keep the wave sheaf offering in this day and age, but it's got spiritual symbolism is very important to a modern day Christian. So you really should think about the wave sheaf offering day, when it is and what it symbolizes. Won't get into that today. And again, where should the barley, this green ears of barley, where should it be sited? Should it be sited in Jerusalem? And I don't even know whether, you know, after reading what Mr. Bardoma said there, I don't even know whether there's barley in the Jerusalem area at all. No. I don't know. Anyway, although barley might be and probably is a secondary indication of the New Year season, because the first fruits of some crop definitely were necessary for the wave sheaf offering, there's so many uncertainties that make the barley sighting a very uncertain method on which to determine the New Year and God's holy days. I believe that the other two major non-CRC options that we're going to look at are based on a much more solid scriptural foundation, and we find that in Genesis chapter 1. Sorry for only a few scriptures today, but let's go to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. And verse 14, Genesis chapter 1 verse 14, and God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven. Why? What for? To divide the day from the night. Is that all? No. And let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. So what were the lights that God created and set in heaven to determine the seasons and the days and the years? And I'm sure that it wouldn't be wrong to include months in here as well, along with the seasons and the days and the years. Verse 16. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also, of course, sun, moon, and the stars. If we go back to verse 14, there's a word there, it says signs, let them be for signs. What does that mean? It's very interesting and significant. In this context, is translated from the Hebrew noun Alf, O-W-T-H, Strong's 226, and it probably stems from the root verb Uth, U-W-T-H, Strong's 225, in the sense of appearing. Elsewhere in the King James Version, Alf is translated as tokens, ensigns, miracles, and marks. It can also mean signal. a distinguishing mark, a banner, a standard, like a flag, a remembrance, a miraculous sign, a warning, or a proof. A proof, and that's the big one to me, a proof. Okay, with that in mind now, let's go to option two for the New Year's. Okay, now the second one that some brethren keep is that the new moon, it's that they start the new year on the new moon that is closest to the vernal equinox, the spring equinox, whether before or after. Okay, so that so this year, the first new moon after the spring equinox is also the closest one to the spring equinox. That's this year. But that's not always the case. For instance, last year in 2013, the new moon that was closest to the spring equinox, I looked it up and I think I'm right, that last year, 2013, the new moon closest to the spring equinox actually occurred 9 days before the equinox. Is that a problem? It could be. It could be a problem. Why? Because the spring equinox is the natural dividing line between winter and spring. So if God were to begin his year before the vernal equinox, he'd be starting his year in the winter instead of the spring. Would that be a problem?
Yes.
Could be. Why? Because if we begin our new year too early, then the fall feasts can arrive too early, even causing the fall feasts, and especially the Feast of Tabernacles, to come in the summer before the time of ingathering. Okay? Let's go over to, and I just want to think about ingathering just for a minute, so that you know. Let's go over to Exodus chapter 23. That those fall feasts have to come at or shortly after the time of ingathering, when they've got, you know, we could go into all of those scriptures about taking, you know, all of the produce that you've grown during the summer and has been reaped at the time of ingathering, and then you sell it, turn it into money, and then you go down to the Feast of Tabernacles. If that doesn't take place at the right time, then that's all going to be thrown off. Okay, Exodus chapter 23 and verse 16. And the feast of harvest, the first fruits of thy labours which thou hast sown in the field, that's Pentecost, and the feast of ingathering, which is in the end of the year, we're going to come back to that, when thou hast gathered in thy labours out of the field. Okay, so right there, that sure gives that. Okay, let's go over to chapter 34, Exodus 34. Exodus chapter 34 and verse 22. Exodus 34:22. And you shall observe the feast of weeks, of the first fruits of the wheat harvest. There's that wheat harvest in the summer, that's Pentecost, and the feast of ingathering at the year's end. At the year's end. So again, the proper holy day timing can be thrown off if we get the wrong timing there, and if we go too early. Okay, the third option then is quite simple. This is the first new moon after the spring equinox. The first new moon after the spring equinox. And again, the title of that virtually speaks for itself. With this method, this is the first new moon. So the first new moon that occurs after the spring equinox, which is March the 20th in most years, the first new moon that occurs after the spring equinox is the first day of the first month of God's new year. So this year, using this method, look at your diagram there, this year using this method, that first new moon after the spring equinox begins on the evening of March the 31st. Okay. So, somebody will say, where does the Bible mention equinox? Where does the Bible mention equinox? Some say that the scriptures don't mention it at all. Another brethren claim that the Hebrew word tekufah refers to the equinoxes. Let's take a look at this word, tekufah. T-E-Q-U-W-P-H-A-H, tekufah. Strong's, Strong's number 8622. You look that up in the King James Version, and you'll see it comes out as the English terms end, circuit, and come about. We're going to read the tekufah verses in a minute because they're interesting. The extended meanings are coming around, circuit of time or space. The circuit aspect is very important. And at the circuit, and a turning. Tekufah stems from the root word nakaph, N-A-Q-A-P-H, and that's Strong's 5362, Strong's 5362, and it appears in the King James Version as compass about, go round about, to go about, and round, and the extended meanings are encompass, surround, to make the round. That's an interesting one as far as the way a year goes. To make rounds and to complete the circuit. I like that one. Complete the circuit. We watched a couple of Sabbaths ago, we got together and we watched one of the orbit series, and it showed kept showing the Earth going around the Sun, you know, in the year there. And this is what you think of as complete the circuit. So from these details here, from the word, it's easy to understand why this term tekufar might be applied to the turn of the year, the completion of the year's circuit, the completion of the Earth's annual revolution around the Sun. So let's look at the tekufar verses. There's four scriptures that contain the word. And so how are their scriptural usages applied in the Bible? Some of them are more significant than the others, but let's go to, we're already in Exodus 34, so let's repeat that verse 22 again. Exodus 34:22, and you shall observe the feast of weeks, of the first fruits of the wheat harvest, and the feast of ingathering at the year's end. And at the year's end is tekufah, okay? So this tekufah obviously would indicate the autumnal equinox. You have two equinoxes every year. One in the spring, March 20th, one in the fall of the autumn. In the same way as you have two solstices, right? In the year, one in the summer, one in the winter. So just as with the first fruits of the wheat harvest in Israel mentioned here can be determined to occur in the late spring to early summer, the ingathering here refers to the main harvest time, obviously not in the spring of the year, but in the autumn of the year. So this tekufah, we know, is in the autumn. So the year's end here appears to refer to the end of the main agricultural growing season. So the timing of this tekufah then is obviously in the autumn at the time of ingathering and right before what we call the fall holy days. I know I'm repeating myself, but it just hammering home the timing here. Okay, this is an interesting one, not really significant. Let's look at it anyway. 1 Samuel chapter 1. It gives you a good idea. It may be not truly significant for the timing of the new year, but it gives you a really good idea of what the word tekufah means. 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 20. 1 Samuel chapter 1 verse 20. Wherefore it came to pass when the time was come about, not tekufah, when the time was come about, after Hannah had conceived, that she bare a son and called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked him of the Lord. Okay, this mention of the word here is referring to the end of a cycle. It's the end of the baby Samuel's 9-month gestation period. Okay, and when the time was come about, so that's the time was his gestation period, so it's the end of a cycle of time. That's what that's trying to get at. Let's look at the next one. Second Chronicles, please. Second Chronicles chapter 24. Second Chronicles 24 2 Chronicles chapter 24 and verse 23. And it came to pass at the end, not Tekufar, at the end of the year, that the host of Syria came up against him, Joash. And they came to Judah and Jerusalem, and destroyed all the princes of the people from among the people, and sent all the spoil of them unto the king of Damascus. So, now this is not very clear, because unless we knew the actual season when this battle took place, it's difficult to know what the end of the year is referring to in this case. Was it at the end of the agricultural year in the autumn, or was it at the end of the whole year in the spring? Don't really know, but we know it's at the end of the year anyway, so gives the idea. Now the next one, the final one, is Psalm 19 verse 6. Psalm 19 verse 6. And this one is wonderful, because this is what we were singing about before. Psalm 19 verse 6. His going forth is from the end of the heaven, and his circuit, that's Tekufah, his circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. What's he talking about? What's this? When he says his, who's he talking about here? Let's go back to find the context. Let's go back to verse 1 to see what David was talking about here in this psalm. And this is a wonderful, wonderful psalm. Verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night shows knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them, the heavens, has he set a tabernacle for the sun, as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices as a strong man to run a race. His going forth is from the end of the heaven, and his circuit to Kufar unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. Now in this psalm, David is extolling God's handiwork, especially as manifested through the marvelous heavens, and more especially the sun in the sky as viewed from the earth. Again, in verse 6, the word his is referring to the sun here. And again, as viewed from the earth, on a daily basis, the sun has a daily circuit. It starts in the east in the morning, and it terminates in the west in the evening. But what's happening here? This apparent daily circuit is due to the spin motion of the earth, and it's relative to where we are. The sun seems to be moving through a daily circuit. The sun also has an annual circuit, but even that one is again, it's as viewed from the earth. In reality, it's the earth, as we mentioned before, that's following a circuit, an orbit around the sun. And you know how fast we're going around the sun? The speed is, I looked this up too, the speed of 65,000 miles an hour. That's how fast the earth is moving around the sun. 65,000 miles an hour. It gets more fantastic. And because the Earth's tilt affects the closeness of any point on Earth to the sun, the sun's daily path in the winter appears to us Earthlings as being very shallow, right? Looking for, yeah, so it comes up over here in the east and is very shallow, and it doesn't get very high in the sky, and then it sets over there. But in the summertime, it appears to ascend much higher into the sky. Of course, we get a longer day from that. On the equinox days, both the spring and the autumn, the tilt of the Earth relative to the sun is reduced to zero. That's at the equator. So if you jumped on an aeroplane, went down to the equator in Africa, South America, one of those places, and you were standing right on the equator on the equinox day, either spring equinox or autumn equinox, the sun would be directly over your head, straight up, and you'd have no shadow. Put your arms out, you'd be able to see the shadows of your arms. If you stood straight, you'd have no shadow. Okay? On the day of the spring equinox, the tilt of the Earth starts pushing the Earth's northern hemisphere closer to the sun. The winter ends, the springtime begins, and the poor old southern hemisphere starts to tilt away from the sun. Its summer ends and its autumn begins. That's all reversed on the day of the autumn equinox. But the sun is also in motion, and the sun does have its own circuit or orbit. The sun is actually moving around the Milky Way galaxy. You know how fast it's going? It's going at the mind-numbing speed of approximately 486,000 miles an hour. So here we are on Earth. We're spinning around every day. There, you know, we've got the moon spinning around us. We're spinning around the sun, and the sun is spinning around the galaxy. Is God wonderful or what? You know, I wanted to bring this out because even though it is only slightly related to the timing, I mean, it's got everything to do with it, and God knows what He's doing. Okay, He really does. Okay. What do you want to say there? Okay, the Earth's circuit around the sun takes how long? A year, right? A solar year. The sun's circuit around the Milky Way, and they've only been able to estimate this, they're not absolutely sure. They say one revolution around the Milky Way for the sun, 226 million years. We, you know, we're going to have to be spirit beings to get our minds around that, you know. Yeah. Okay. Big question, though. Does the use of the equinox in determining the new year, does it fit in with Genesis chapter 1, 14 to 17? Yes, it does. Okay. Better, I believe, certainly better than... And again, I'm not knocking those people who want to view the barley, but I believe that this fits in with the requirements of Genesis chapter 1. And are the equinoxes, are they sub-signs? We remember the word sign that we looked up before. Are the equinoxes sub-signs of the sun, moon, and stars? Well, yes, they certainly are, as we've seen. Okay. How should we look at the new year? And this is not really important, but it's kind of an interesting thing to think about. Should we look at the new year as the end of an old year or the beginning of a new year? It's like asking if a glass is half full or half empty. But in the King James Version, the English word year is usually translated from the Hebrew word shana, Strong's number 8141, which is also translated in the King James Version as yearly lies and old, which is kind of interesting, old. So we look at the old year's end, and again, I'm running out of time, so I'm not able to go into all of these scriptures. If I can, I'll come back with another episode in a month or so, and we'll go through, because they're really interesting scriptures here. But there's more than one Bible term for the end of the year, and I'll just let you know what the scriptural words are in addition to Tekufah, which we've already covered. And again, I wish I had the time to go through them all in detail, but I don't. Well, let me tell you what they are, and if you want to look them up, you can, and then we'll, if I have the opportunity, I'll come back and we'll go through them. First one is Tamam, Strong's 8552, and it means consume. So think of the old year being consumed, it comes an end, finished, but also spent, perfected, done, accomplished. Can apply all of those to the end of the year? Yeah, I think so. It's also interesting when you think about our preparations for the Passover, that it can also mean clean and upright. Okay. Next one is Yatsa. That sounds like a Jewish word, doesn't it? Yatsa. Y-A-T-S-A. Strong's 3318. And it means out, forth, like going forward here, forth, proceed, go, depart. So it's like departing from that old year, proceeding and going forward into that new year. Another one is a really lovely word is acharith, acharith, A-C-H-A-R-I-Y-T-H, Strong's 319. Which means end, latter, last, or hindermost. And the last word is Ketz, Q-E-T-S, Strong's 7093, means end, after, and border. I like border when you think of the day of the new moon there. Okay, that's for the end of the old year. There's a few Bible terms for the beginning of the new year too, and again, we don't have time to go through them today. One is Reshith, R-E-S-H-I-Y-T-H, Strong's 7225, which means beginning, and these are how it's translated in the King James Version: beginning, first fruits, and first. That's good. You know, first fruits can certainly be applied to the wave sheaf offering, and the word first, obviously, the first day of the first month of the year. And the other word is Rosh, as in Rosh Hashanah, right? And that's Strong's 7218. It means head, chief, top, beginning, and then we can apply it to Jesus Christ, captain, ruler, and sum, S-U-M, first, principle. So, again, we could probably have a full hour's Bible study just going over those words and applying them in the context of the sacred calendar. So, we've had lots of variety, I think, today, in today's sermon. Lots of, hopefully, colourful facts. But the main things that I wanted to cover today were the basic options for the determination of the new moon days and the new years. And I hope I was able to succeed in doing that. But if you found any of it confusing, I'm sorry, but please don't hesitate to contact me and I'll do my best to clarify anything that I wasn't able to make clear the first time around. So, where are we now? We're just a few weeks away from Passover, and I want to put this on hold now. I love the study of it. I've really been enjoying it, and there's a few more things that we can look into that I wasn't able to get into today. I'm going to leave them till after Passover, after the Feast of Unleavened Bread, I'm not sure whether I'll be speaking between now. I've got a sermon in CGI next week, and then we're still working out our plans where we're going to be for the Holy Days. But I think that the main thing that I want to ask you to do is that you will make your decision, you know, based on what we've talked about today. If you haven't already made a decision, that you will make one, and be confident in, you know, if you want to keep the CRC, again, I'm not going to knock it, you know, I'm not going to criticize you for that. If you feel that it's time for you to pull away from the CRC and for the mainstream Churches of God way of doing it, we'll certainly pray for you, because it's not going to be an easy road, as many have found out, and we'll certainly pray about that. And whichever alternative that you decide on, pray about it. Ask God to give you the confidence and to show you the right way to go. We're doing the same thing. I believe everybody is. Yeah, it's true. Different brethren are coming up with different answers. And one day God's going to straighten us all out on those things, and these things are going to become more and more clear. I believe they are. I believe that there's releasing scriptures in there somewhere that we're going to come across, and we're going to go, you know, why didn't I see that before? You know, I know that that's going to happen. So thanks for your attention, brethren, and again. If I don't talk to you again before Passover, I encourage you. It's time for self-examination. It's time for preparation of time for de-leavening. It's time for preparations, physical preparation and spiritual preparation for God's Holy Day. So we do hope and pray that there will be a wonderful and meaningful for all of us.